Gary Noll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our report is on America's media, the PSYOPs, and how America has become a nation where we have victims of government misinformation and oppression. We have a number of panelists to join us today. Among our panelists will be Joshim Hagopian. Mr. Hagopian has been a practicing clinical psychologist and marriage counselor in California for over 25 years. And from a congressional appointment, he attended the U.S. Military Academy at West Point through a congressional appointment in the late 1960s. After clashing with the system, he was railroaded out of that at the end of his third year. This resulted in his filing charges against the Academy with failure to allow due process, and he won the case in New York Federal District Court. This case set the precedent that continues today for cadets that the right to present their case and witness before the Academy. His story is retold in his manuscript book, Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down, and his writings have focused upon education, geopolitics, the national security and police state, and the international relations for global research. And we are welcoming him first. We have other panelists. We'll have Ross Caputi. Ross is a former Marine who served from 2003-2006 and took part in the second siege of Fallujah in Iraq in 2004. And he has been openly critical of the military policies and actions. He was discharged in 2006. And since then, Ross went on to found and direct the Justice for Fallujah Project, a group of veterans, students, and citizens dedicated to raising awareness about the suffering of people of Fallujah and the U.S. war crimes committed there. Among the project board members are Noam Chomsky and others. He is also the director of the recent documentary Fear Not the Path of Truth, A Veteran's Journey After Fallujah. He holds a master's in linguistics, has written for Global Research and The Guardian, and his website is thefallujahproject.org. They will be joined by John Rappaport. John has worked as an investigative reporter for over 30 years, writing about politics and corporatocracy and the medical cartels and the media, the culture of our society. And he has been an award-winning journalist. He has hosted and produced and written radio programs. And he has also been on ABC's Nightline, Tony Brown's Journal, Hard Copy. And for the past 10 years, John has operated largely away from the mainstream because, as he puts it, his research was not friendly to the conventional media. He runs a website with many years of research and articles called NoMoreFakeNews.com. I'd like to welcome all of you to our program today. And for those of you who have not heard this program in the past, we take one single issue and we explore it in depth. I raise the questions, but then allow the panelists an opportunity in turn to explore them in a context they feel we can learn from. And so that's what we're going to be doing. Nice to have you with us today, and we're going to be starting with you, Mr. Hagopian.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. I'd like for you to take us on a journey here. I'd like to start with a question which came to mind after I read a recent article written by our second guest, former Marine Ross Caputi, on global research, but it's very relevant to all the research you have been performing. When we look at all the news given out to us over the mainstream media and cable media, even some of the alternative media, and you listen to our politicians and the media pundits who have, let's say, revolved around the circle door between Washington and the private think tanks and the corporations, when we listen to them discuss important issues, it more often than not appears that what the average American citizen or the general population is being told what they want to know is not the truth, but rather partial truths, half-truths. And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned that we get our financial information from people who have a vested interest in Wall Street. Our medical information comes from people from the pharmaceutical industry. They're the ones who appear as so-called experts from their think tanks to tell us what drugs we should take and miracle new cures. We get our advice on education standards from private groups that want to privatize and commercialize education. And we get our information on national security and defense from people heavily vested in the ideology that wherever there's a conflict, we have to use overwhelming force to subvert it. If it's invading Gaza or Iraq, it is never what the American people want that is part of the equation, but rather U.S. foreign policy interest, which simply translates to corporate interest. So with that said, would you agree with this observation or not? And then, as a psychologist, what effect do you believe this has on the minds of Americans and the shaping of their opinions and views on any given national subject? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Sure. Well, I think that basically 9/11 was a coup. And we have a government that is representing the corporations and no longer the people. And therefore, we have a propaganda department called mainstream media that puts out state-sponsored information, disinformation, and propaganda. And, I mean, the majority of the American public is aware that the government is lying to them. Recent polls have showed 60-70% know that they're being lied to and distrust the government. Upwards of 75-80% of the American public are aware that mainstream media is not telling them the truth.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Let me just take it off track for a moment, but still it's relevant to the larger issue, the psychodynamics of this. I'm just completing a major documentary. I'm on my way back to the city after being on the road for 3 months. And I've been on the road almost 7 years filming this, and it all has to do with poverty. But it's not just about focusing upon someone who's poor and what they do each day, though I do that. It's the new poor. It's the people that never you would have thought would be poor because they're highly educated. Some have masters, PhDs, graduates from major Ivy League schools, and yet they're homeless today. And others are not homeless, but they're a prisoner in their home because maybe it's a person in their 60s, their home was paid for, but they lost their job, and now they cannot afford taxes, utilities, medicine, and food. And all the while this is going on, no one seems to care. We don't have any major movement to stop home foreclosures. We don't have any major movement to bring those accountable for causing the financial mess to justice. In fact, Wall Street's very happy to pay massive fines because they pay the fine and it's back to business and they can borrow all they want from the Federal Reserve and they go out there and create the debt that they have into an asset. They buy things. They monopolize things. And yet the average person's just kind of immune from feeling this. And then I saw this evolve to an even deeper level where now it's against the law to be homeless in communities and live there. In fact, now you cannot feed the homeless in a park in Orlando. Even a church group that I interviewed said that they would take food out, warm food, on Sundays, and their members, their congregation, would serve the homeless people. It was all very quiet. In fact, one of the ministers said, what's amazing is that everything is super quiet. They ate, they were polite, they thanked the church, and then everybody cleaned up and you would never know where they were there. Now that's illegal. You can go to jail if you do that. You can go to jail if you take someone in and give them comfort. You cannot, now they're making it against law to house in any way, shape, or form homeless people. Then they can arrest you if you're homeless. and you don't have any money. That's why you're homeless. You can't even afford food that day. You're sleeping on the street. So they then put you in a private jail. Now, this isn't, and then charge you, and you go before a private probation officer, and you're assessed all kinds of penalties that you will never get out of. All this is being done in clear sight. So on the one hand, I have to ask a simple question. Yes, we know the banks. We know Wall Street. We know the politicians. We know ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. We know the K Street lobbyist. We know all these people. These people's attitudes are as close to being psychopathic as imaginable. They have absolutely no concern for the consequences to anyone or nature or animals or humans for their actions. But what about all the people who don't want a homeless person in their neighborhood? I've interviewed them. What about the millions of Americans who won't give a dime to a homeless person? But if suddenly something's in the news and a stray dog goes onto a highway and a citizen stops the car, true story, I've got it posted on my website, and goes over and rescues the dog, which otherwise would be absolutely killed because the cars are whizzing by and there's no exit for this dog. So this one citizen picks the dog up, takes it back to her car, and then rescues it. And everybody goes, oh, how good that is. That person's so good. Well, you're not doing it. Who's doing it? That rare person, and I'm thinking, what does it say when we have a nation addicted to Facebook, addicted to Twittering, addicted to passively spectating everyone else's suffering, but not doing a damn thing to engage to try to stop it? And I'm seeing this, now we've gotten to a place where if you're poor in America, and 200 million Americans are, you're to be shunned, you're to be thrown out of their town. Get out of our town. We're good Christians. We're good people. We don't want you around. You're a good Christian? What part of Christianity are you good at? I'm confused about this. Please take this example, true stories I just gave to you, and tell us how in the hell, as a nation, the general population has degraded itself to such low spiritual values.
Yeah, it's it really is a quandary to try and figure out how people can be, on the one hand, Christian and church-going and all of this, and then their behavior towards other humans is, like, so cold and like, you know, not in my house or neighborhood. I think what we have here by design is a propaganda mill where we've become enraptured by our technology and our little push-button devices and our toys. And, I mean, it's a form of escapism because people know they have some anxiety and they don't want to deal with the reality out there. So they, you know, devote a lot of their energy to escapist activity. And I think they just kind of shut their hearts down from, having any kind of compassion or humanitarian feelings about their fellow human beings. The stuff going on in Gaza, I mean, there's a war on people, on all the average everyday people of the world, I believe, because it's not even just an American thing. There's austerity across the boards economically. In our country, we don't have a manufacturing sector left. We have upwards of 25% people unemployed, and that doesn't even include the people that have given up looking. We have adults moving into their parents' home. We have indentured servant college graduates unable to pay off their huge loans. We have no more upward mobility. The American dream is dead. This is a lot of horror going on, and yeah, it's amazing that there's not a lot more people in an uproar over what the government is doing to us in their tyranny and oppression. It's just amazing to me.
But on a psychological level, please explain to us why people are... Look at what they're not addressing. Poverty, homelessness, the illegal... activities of our national security state, the militarization of our police, stop and search of African Americans and people of color, the 40,000 to 80,000 SWAT team raids last year, where enormous amount of violence for just misdemeanor, like serving a summons that historically just required a service of a non-officer. All of these things are happening, and you see no protest. When the bankers are ripping us off, there's no protest. Now, you mentioned something about we don't manufacture anymore. I track this. I spent almost 9 months tracking the fact that for 30 years we have outsourced and or caused a change in over 30 million Americans' job positions.
Yeah.
We have not protested that. So the irony of it is, instead of protesting, it's like the Stockholm Syndrome, we'll go to Walmart to buy something cheap made in China that we used to make with a living wage in our community. We're not protesting. There's no solidarity against this. We're not boycotting the usurious rates on payday loans. We're not protesting and boycotting the destruction of our environment. We're not doing it. The only few things we can get people to protest on are like genetic engineering of food. That we're doing good there. But we didn't do good in California. Now, that doesn't surprise me from where you're at, because I'll tell you something. Man, if people could be influenced by commercials that were paid for by the grocery manufacturers, Monsanto and DuPont, and all the companies that use their genetically engineered materials, but not want their products labeled. It's as if they've stopped using critical thought analysis before they decide, no, we don't want it labeled. But you did.
Yeah.
I know, but I saw propaganda on television disguised as information, and I chose not to use critical thinking. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, the polls up to a month before Monsanto poured all that advertising money in, the public was in favor of it, and then, you know, they are, unfortunately, the public is so gullible that they will vote against their own best interests based on propaganda. And my view to the bigger question that you're asking is, I believe that so many people are struggling just to survive today, that they, when it's overload, they don't pay attention to other people's plights and problems, because everybody is just in it for themselves to try and stay afloat. That's what I think. I think that we're in an emergency mode now. Our population of just struggling to survive, and they don't have the room for being good Samaritans and humanitarian for their fellow citizens. I think that's another tragic consequence of how dire our situation is here in America, that people don't care anymore. But I see it as they're just so self-absorbed with their own world and their own problems that they don't have the time and energy and compassion and heart to pay attention to, you know, other people. That's what I think, anyway.
We're also looking at the larger picture today, the kind of psyops, which is really impacting our educational system and government media propaganda and the disinformation blitz. Could you go through some of the propaganda media and how they structured it? Because they had to use behavioralists and psychologists, or frequently behavioralists or psychologists, to figure out how do you sell a lie. Now,
yeah.
I know that Edward Bernay was the master, and he was one who proved way back in the 20th century that if you tell a lie in a way that people want to believe, they'll believe it. Even when they're faced with the truth, they won't separate it. And
yeah.
then look at how that lie, of that ability to lie, has influenced weapons of mass destruction. We must go into Iraq. Libya is a national threat, and we must send NATO in. Syria is a threat to the whole Middle East, and we have to arm moderate terrorist militant groups to go in there. Every single time they do something, they had the majority of the American public on their side before they do it. They have the majority of the legislators, and they have the majority of the media. And when they're shown to be wrong, there is no consequence. But if you, as a practicing clinical psychologist, as a counselor for over a quarter of a century, as a scholar in your field, if you were to screw up, and if you were to give advice repeatedly to your clients that caused them to go and commit suicide or make terrible decisions, you would be railed out of the profession, you would be disgraced, and you would be monikered as a quack. There is a double standard. Why is it that when they commit crimes, no one holds them accountable? And my last thought on this is this. I wanted to see whether or not we were projecting in the wrong way. So I hired two attorneys. And their mission was, however long it took, and it took nearly a year, find me every lawsuit that has been settled by pharmaceutical companies and Wall Street firms. I want to know how many lawsuits, what they were about, what the amount was, if it's available. At the end of a year, I couldn't believe how many lawsuits. They had so many lawsuits, they couldn't give me the full lawsuit, just an abstract, because it was over 300,000. Every major Wall Street firm and bank, investment house, every single pharmaceutical company that you could think of had settled not just one or 10 or 100 or 1,000, but tens of thousands of lawsuits for billions upon billions of dollars. And some of these lawsuits were settled where the crimes were really very serious. And I didn't want any lawsuit that applied that was thrown out or frivolous. I just wanted to see what they've been found guilty of. They are serial sociopaths. They're serial criminals. Yet they can walk into any person's office in the United States, the President of the United States, any member of Congress. They are considered the best and brightest and elite, and they're all serial criminals. The actual evidence exists. You will not find any one of them ever, ever monikered as a sociopath or a criminal in the media. Not once will you find that. Why?
We have a oligarchy in this country that protects those in power. There are the people in the shadowy mansions where, you know, they are more invisible, but they are behind the scenes calling the shots to basically the class of people that are, as you're talking about, the well-educated, Ivy League and all of that. And they got them as their servants, basically, in the government and in the corporations. And they're the middle people. And then there's the rest of us, which is like 99% of the population, or basically 90% or something like that. So, I mean, they've taken over the government. And so it's all about protecting their interests. And the interests of the people, unfortunately, have been lost. You know, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi director of propaganda, he came up with some basic truths here. If you tell a lie often enough and keep repeating it, people will believe it. And that's what's happened in this country. The media just keeps repeating the same narratives of lies, and unfortunately, too many people are still buying it. Now, more and more people, though, are turning to alternative sources for their news and information. And that is encouraging. More people are, I know that your show is extremely popular. More people are tuning in all the time. The news site that I write for, Global Research, you know, there's a lot of sites out there that are becoming bigger sources of information for people because they're looking for the truth. They're starved for the truth, and they're not getting it from mainstream. So, you know, I think that the tide is turning, and I think more and more people are realizing that their government is an oligarchy, and they're not going to be out to help them or protect their interests. So I think it's a matter of just mobilizing forces that will basically, you know, challenge the government. I think we need to go in the courts and start enforcing the Constitution. These decisions have been so much based on unconstitutional law practice, and we have a government here that has a constitution that is supposed to be the foundation of our laws, the rule of law, and it's not being applied. And so I think on the local and the state levels, that's where we have to really mobilize to try and make some kind of impact on the federal level, because the federal government is completely out of control. Because they're completely puppets of the oligarch and the corporatized system. So,
well,
you know,
one
it's up to us to band together and mobilize our power to oppose the oppression and the tyranny and the lies.
All right. I have a segue to a topic based on what you just said. Here we have the Tea Party. Here we have a lot of conservatives, not Republicans, but authentic conservatives. Here we have a lot of progressive liberals, and they're all saying the same thing.
Yeah.
We're not opposed to government. We're opposed to excessive government that does not represent the interests of the people.
Right.
We're not opposed to taxes. We're opposed to corporate America not paying their fair share of taxes, and yet we have no choice but to pay them because we can't afford very expensive tax lawyers to go through the 70,000 pages of the tax code to find the loopholes.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be better to have a flat tax? Yes, that's what they want. These discussions are not happening now. So you say, well, if you really believe in the Constitution, if you really believe in the Bill of Rights, if you believe that we should be living by these standards, then why aren't you protesting against the people on Fox, all of whom support the government that's in power when they have their representatives, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity? I don't see them out protesting. I don't see them putting themselves in a position to be challenged. But I don't see them challenging the excessive militarization of the world. I don't see them challenging the fact that we have 18 million hungry children who go to bed at night in the United States, food insecure. But I do see them saying, don't touch the military-industrial spy complex budget. But it's a spy complex spying on you by private industries that are doing it illegally. Are you still wanting us to pay them for doing it? And they will not touch that subject. They say it's sacred. You do not. And what I'm saying, there's one agency of the Pentagon in its audit found that 10 separate companies were all doing the same identical work on one contract, and it was over $1 billion. That meant we paid 9 other companies to do the work that one was supposed to do, and there is absolutely no accountability. So if you took the national defense budget down to what we actually need to defend ourselves, it's about $200 billion. But they won't do it. It keeps growing. Power within the government bureaucracies becomes almost like a metastasizing cancer, except this cancer doesn't kill you. It simply takes over the organs and has total control over your heart, your lungs, your brain. And I'm not seeing any of these groups that rail against government excess talk about corporate welfare. There's a lot of excess that's not benefiting the public. Tax dodging by corporations that we could bring $30 trillion back in the United States if we gave them a one-time forgiveness fee of 20%. That's trillions of dollars that we would get. Stop outsourcing jobs. I don't hear them standing saying, I will vote against any legislator. I will expose anyone who votes to outsource any more jobs. It's not done. So I'm seeing that the media and the people who are the advocates are extremely biased, are not representing the people, and a whole group of people in the United States say they're for something, and you don't see them actually doing anything about it. Final thoughts, please.
I agree with you. I think there's a very vast, loud majority in the media that may rail against Obama and Democrats and all of that, and then they don't back up any of it with actual challenge of our military policy around the world and the huge defense budget, which is all about it should have been, the name should have stayed Department of War, because that's exactly what it is. Rather than defense. There's just so much inconsistency. And I think that, there's so much corruption as far as people paying others off to keep them quiet. Blackmail, bribery, all of this stuff goes on. We don't hear the truth because somebody's got the dirt on the other person, and then there's this pressure to bribe for get your way, so you pay enough money to the politicians, to the courts. It's a very corrupt system we're living under right now.
One short answer before we go to our next panelist. And that is, explain the psychological differences based upon what we know in the modern psychology and neuroscience today between groupthink or group mind and the kind of individual mind of critical thought and creativity and innovation and independence that philosophers and mystics have spoken about for ages. And the second, once a person identifies with the fabrication of group mind, how is it to become easier to manipulate him or her?
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing in Common Core, which is the federalized curriculum that's being imposed on all the school districts of our nation, 43 out of 50 states have adopted it. It's a whole con job with group mind. You're only of value if you contribute to the group. And what I see of that is kind of like a communist kind of view, rather than strive toward. It's a total propaganda piece, and it's all about testing and performance, and basically it's labeling people early based on a test performance. I see it goes very deep as far as trying to reach the young people and get them to basically give up their individual rights for the group. It's pretty incredible, the propaganda that's being put on the people, and it's something that we need to get together and start really challenging. I really applaud your show for taking on this topic, because we don't hear too many people in the media talking about this. They're all lip service to the status quo.
Well, I appreciate that kind thought. Stay on the line. I'd like to bring our next guest and then hear your comments or feedback at the end on these topics. Let's go over and say hello to Ross Caputi, that's C-A-P-U-T-I, a former U.S. Marine who served in Iraq, in Fallujah, and was a part of the second siege. Nice to have you with us today, Ross.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ross, I want you to give us an insight on Fallujah, because we're not really, the average American is completely clueless on this, and because you were there. And the media painted one picture. I remember at the time on Fox, they'd have Geraldo on, arguing with, who was over there, arguing with Bill O'Reilly on an issue. And always it was our brave men and women. Never once was there a comment about depleted uranium, dead children, innocent civilians. So, and all the debates over the wars and conflicts and coup d'etats and insurrections the U.S. plays a role in, either directly or indirectly, the focus is always upon the parties in conflict and not the people who are victims to these conflicts. And right now, regarding Gaza, we only hear about the fundamentalist Israeli government in power, or Hamas, or U.S. and European foreign policy and our political parties, and only that is what we're hearing about. We're not actually seeing, not in the United States, you can see it on BBC and Al Jazeera and others, the actual civilians, people who are not supporting Hamas, just civilians, and how they're being massacred at this moment. The same can be said for Ukraine and its new fascist regime in the U.S.-Russia standoff. But we don't hear about the Ukrainians and how they're suffering. And you've observed this firsthand in Iraq in your time during the U.S. invasion of Fallujah in 2004. And one area where brainwashing is conducted constantly is in the military. The military personnel are only supposed to have one source of information about the events they're engaged in and about events back home and elsewhere in the world, and that is from the higher echelons of the military, chain of command. So please take your time and share with us your firsthand interpretations of events, of what you saw versus what we were told.
Okay, so I think I'll try to talk about the research that I've been doing on information operations and psyops to kind of tie it into what you guys have been talking about, and then kind of segue into my own personal experience. So I think there was a series of information operations and PSYOPs conducted by the U.S. military that began around the first siege of Fallujah. And I think a lot of the, a big reason why I allowed myself to participate in the second siege of Fallujah is that I knew nothing about the first siege of Fallujah. The first siege of Fallujah was largely a revenge operation where we sort of collectively punished the entire city of Fallujah, which is a city of 300,000 people. It's a city roughly the size of Boston. Because of this incident where these four American mercenaries were driving through the city, they were ambushed by a local militia, and then their bodies were mutilated by an angry mob. So in response to that, the U.S. military launched a siege where they completely surrounded the city, trapped 300,000 people within the city, and then began a large-scale operation using air support, tanks, heavy weaponry in densely populated neighborhoods. Roughly 700 civilians were killed during this operation. And at this point, during this operation, the Army began a psychological operation. And this was at a point of maximal Sunni and Shia unity within Iraq. Sunni and Shia militias were conducting joint operations against the U.S. military, and this was a very dangerous thing to have this united resistance movement fighting against the U.S. military. So what they did was they conducted the PSYOP, which exaggerated the role of this Mujahideen fighter, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. They claimed that he was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq and that he was based in Fallujah, and that he was recruiting a army out of this city. This turned out to be completely false. Nobody in Fallujah has ever seen this man. There's zero tangible evidence that this man ever even set foot in Fallujah. But this became the justification for continued U.S. military action in Fallujah after the first siege of Fallujah, which led into the second siege of Fallujah. This was the major justification for the operation that I was part of, which killed roughly 4,000 civilians, destroyed the entire city, created 200,000 refugees for something that turned out to be not true at all. In parallel to the PSYOP, there was also information operations going on. And what information operations are, from the military perspective, is sort of the controlled release of information or propaganda. And they considered their loss during the first siege of Fallujah to be to the enemy's superior use of information operations. They claim that the enemies welcomed in the Al Jazeera news agency and used them as sort of a propaganda agency to lie about civilian casualties. Al Jazeera's reporting was corroborated from a number of different sources. All of their reports checked out with hospital reports about casualty figures. Yet the U.S. military dismissed all civilian deaths as information operations by the enemy. And this continued all the way up to Fallujah during the second operation. They considered the Fallujah hospital to be a center of information operation propaganda for the enemy. So when we laid siege to Fallujah for the second time, our very first objective was the hospital. And, you know, we took control of the hospital, which is a war crime, according to the Geneva Conventions. And we justified this by saying that, you know, we were taking away an information operation platform from the enemy. So I think, you know, in conjunction, what these two operations did was it created this idea that there is this group of bad guys within Fallujah. They're opposing this legitimate political project that we have going on in Iraq to create this government. And they're doing so because, you know, their religion tells them to fight against Americans for whatever reason. In that, you know, the U.S. did this justly. We were a legitimate military force conducting a discriminated operation to save Iraqis. I think this is anything but the truth. Based on my own experience, all I saw was, you know, we were conducting ourselves completely indiscriminately, really just, you know, making life miserable for the Iraqi population. But I think this idea still lives on today in what's going on in Iraq, that we believe that the government that exists in Iraq today is a legitimate government and that it's a legitimate political action for Obama and the Obama administration to continue to support this government, even though they've been waging a genocide against the Sunni population for the last 6 months. So I think this misinformation campaign, which began in 2004, is bleeding into our understanding of what's going on in Iraq today. And this is one kind of tangible example of the sort of information operations and psyops that you guys were talking about earlier.
I appreciate that insight. Back to Iraq for a moment, since you were there. Today I was listening to Ann Coulter. I've never taken a drug in my life, but I could have been forgiven for having listened to her if I did. She was talking with Sean Hannity, and they were talking about how we should have stayed in Iraq, if we stayed in Iraq and Afghanistan, if we stayed everywhere. And she was just saying, hey, we've got troops in 100 different countries around the world, and that's a good thing. And look, we got them in Germany and Korea, and there wouldn't be this problem because we would have managed. And I'm thinking, you're kidding. Surely, you're fully aware that when we went in there, the Shia had been repressed and the Sunni, the Ba'athist party, was in charge and got all the preferred jobs because that was Saddam Hussein's party. But then Paul Brenner immediately discharged all of the Sunnis from all operations, and that led to absolute chaos and the sectarian violence. And then there was an intentional selection of the candidates. Remember how Cheney and all of them wanted Chalabi, a notorious criminal who had already been tried and found guilty in absentia in Jordan for stealing $100 million from a bank there. And yet he was the neocon's favorite to run Iraq. So we selected the parties, the people who were going to run it. We excluded Sunnis, and then we put Maliki in power, who then persecuted the Sunnis. They were the ones who were being arrested, their houses broken into by American forces and by Iraqi forces, special forces, and that led to the sectarian violence. It was only when it was decided, let's pay these people, let's pay 100,000 people $400 a month and $8 million to the sheikh who runs them, if they become a part of the Sunni, Sunni rising, and so they're no longer fighting each other because we're paying them and arming them not to. And I'm thinking, then why don't you take a look at the problems we have there today and ask yourself, we messed their country up. We created an imbalance. It was not imbalanced until we got there. It may not have been fair, but it was not going to be the bloodbath that we saw. Why can't that conversation about what really happened and how we caused the people to go at each other, and that's where we're at today. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess it goes against sort of the fundamental assumption of who we are and, you know, what this country does. There's sort of this imperialist way of thinking, which is very much alive in America, that we have the right to go into other people's countries and change their government, and we can decide for them what sort of government is the good government for them to have, and we're going to empower the Iraqis that we think are good Iraqis, and we're going to kill the Iraqis that we think are bad Iraqis. And we have the right to do this because we're exceptional. And yeah, that it's sort of just unquestionable from an American mentality. It's so part of who we are that it's invisible. We can't even see it, I think.
How do you understand psyops at work in the military? And I ask this because the majority of enlisted men enter the service, performing their 3, 4, 5 years, then are discharged and average citizens again. And one might surmise that by channeling and funneling more and more young adults through the military today, the ruling class in America is creating the perfect, obedient, patriotic citizens for a social class that will only serve this class in the policies of Washington. Is that, and that's what's being discussed, do you feel that that's legitimate as an argument or not?
So my understanding of psyops from the military perspective, it sort of targets more the emotions and the fears of individuals, whereas the information operations target more information on a propositional level. So, for example, this psyop that I mentioned about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, this was targeted at the Iraqi population to leverage their fear of foreigners in Iraq. The military was trying to make them afraid of foreign fighters like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who they claimed was a very sectarian person. Maybe he was. It's not even clear if this man was really a fighter in Iraq or not. But they wanted to drive a wedge between the local population in Iraq, and the foreign militants were flooding into the country as a humanitarian intervention. So that's my understanding of PSYOPs. Information ops, I think, you know, is more kind of on the informational level, you know, like I mentioned in Fallujah, sort of dismissing all civilian deaths as enemy propaganda, and therefore claiming that all of our bombings are surgical strikes and we don't kill civilians, so on and so forth. And it certainly bleeds into to the news media here at the U.S., sort of fear-mongering we see in the media and the deliberate manipulation of information. So, yeah.
What war crimes, or what you could interpret as war crimes, did you actually experience, that you witnessed?
Well, arguably, everything in Iraq was a war crime because the invasion itself was illegal. This can be characterized as a crime against humanity, and in particular, the crime of aggression, which the crime of aggression, by the way, was defined at the Nuremberg Tribunal, encompasses everything that follows after it. So if you're guilty of the crime of aggression, everything you do after that, whether it be, you know, your average mundane foot patrol or a PSYOP or whatever it is, it's all illegal. So arguably everything after the invasion in the spring of 2003 was illegal. But the more specific sort of war crimes that we saw in Fallujah were, you know, general failure to distinguish between the civilian population and enemy combatants, using indiscriminate weapons, using indiscriminate tactics, failure to discriminate between civilian structures and enemy structures. Like I said, we were bombing residential neighborhoods. The hospital was bombed on another number of occasions. We actually took control of the hospital. We were using tactics like reconnaissance by fire, which is when you fire into an area to figure out if there's enemies in there. So it's indiscriminate by definition. By definition, you don't know what you're firing at. We were using experimental weapons in Fallujah. We were bulldozing houses to the ground, bulldozing entire neighborhoods to the ground. And we did not let the adult male population leave the city. They were forced to stay within the city. Women and children were intimidated or encouraged to leave, but males were forced to stay within the city, and then we, you know, attacked the city in this indiscriminate manner that I've been describing. So on a whole number of levels, it was just it was one large war crime from the way the mission was structured.
Well, we didn't get that on our media, which, since they were embedded, they knew the truth, so all those embedded reporters were simply giving the party line. Shame on them. Ross, thank you. Stay on, let's say, go to John Rappaport in San Diego. John has worked as an award-winning investigative journalist for over 30 years. Nice to have you with us, John.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here.
John, the PSYOPs of fear and misinformation in the health field is also something we rarely hear about. And yet we're all affected, the swine flu, Ebola, you name it. So I'd like you to speak about media misinformation and propaganda as a kind of persuasive form of mind control to get citizens to buy into a paradigm they believe is there to protect them and keep them healthy. So there are so many prongs to this, pushing vaccines at the slightest outbreak of infectious disease. We saw it in the spread of the H1N1 swine flu scare earlier, which was a bust but enabled our federal health officials to ramp up their skills for future health-related scares. We saw it in the past with HIV and AIDS also, the anthrax scare shortly after 9/11, and Ebola now. So take your time, use examples, and speak on how our federal health officials, agencies, and government monopolize the message of fear to influence citizens towards a particular end.
Well, I think it starts with an appointed class of experts. This is what major media do, not just in this area, but in all areas. The reporters have their, quote, sources. These medical experts from various public health agencies like the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, and universities, which are all really part of the same apparatus, tell reporters what is going on, for example, with the latest outbreak. You know, we had the swine flu outbreak. And so the reporters take all of their information from these so-called experts. And one epidemic, in heavy quotes, after another, the public is conditioned to believe whatever they're being told through the press by these same people over and over and over again. For example, that swine flu is threatening to become a global pandemic, when in fact, in retrospect, the World Health Organization declared it to be a level 6 pandemic, which is its highest category of danger, in the spring of 2009. Based on only 20 cases that have been diagnosed. And they changed their definition of what a pandemic was at that point to rule out the necessity of widespread death and severe suffering. So really, it was all a kind of shadow play, a charade that was being played out to scare the public, this impending disaster that was going to take over the world and so on and so forth. We see this, and I mean, I as a reporter have been watching this for, you know, since 1985 or so, where the paradigm really is germ, 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 over and over again, one germ after another, West Nile, HIV, SARS, bird flu, smallpox, swine flu, Ebola. It goes on and on and on and on. The same pattern is repeated. This is going to be the big one. Yes, the last one wasn't, but this one really is. And so now you have to take a vaccine if we develop it. And of course, Obama has recently signed an order that any person in the United States can now be quarantined if he has a lung infection or is even suspected of possibly coming in contact with somebody with Ebola, whether or not that person is, that person could be perfectly healthy, symptom-free, it doesn't matter. This is all really political. But what's left out of the equation is the most important thing, which, of course, you never hear about in major media, and that is the strength of the immune system, which determines whether or not a person is going to get sick, whether or not a germ is going to have any effect. But to mention that and describe it and promote it and educate people about it would begin to take all the fear out of the germ, 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 germ imagery that we hear and see on television. And that would be counterproductive as far as the government is concerned, as far as the U.S. medical system is concerned, as far as the pharmaceutical companies are concerned who make the drugs to kill the germs and make the vaccines to, as they claim, to prevent the germs from causing disease in the first place. So with every new germ, there is a propaganda operation to instill fear and imagery to go along with it. For example, the main image right now of Ebola that's been promoted to the public is people suddenly and without warning hemorrhaging at any given moment, huge gouts of blood pouring out of their body. And if somebody happens to be nearby and a drop of blood falls on them, they could immediately become infected and die. Well, that's ridiculous, because in a majority of cases, that doesn't happen. There are many other symptoms of so-called Ebola. And yet this is promoted to instill tremendous fear, and it works. And I've been writing a number of articles on Ebola, and I noticed from the responses that I get that there are a certain amount of people who will never be convinced that the paradigm or the scenario that is being forwarded by the mainstream press could be any different from what it is, because in some part of their psychology, their consciousness, they're paralyzed by that image of a person suddenly vomiting blood as a result of a little tiny virus. And they never, ever recover psychologically from that image. So no matter what you tell them, that's what they see in their mind's eye. And that is purposeful, that propaganda. That is not just accidental. That is done with each one of these epidemics. And in turn, these fake epidemics, which is what they are, because they never go on to spread globally and kill half the planet, as, you know, we're warned. Each of these epidemics is there in order to impress on the mind of the population that all disease starts from a germ. That's what it's all about. Doesn't matter whether you're healthy, strong, weak, whatever. If the germ is there, it could kill you. It's out of your hands. You have no power to control your own health or your body's response to germs. Therefore, you must rely on the pharmaceutical companies and the U.S. medical systems and what your doctor tells you, and on the mainstream press to inform you of the latest threat, and you have to follow orders. You have to take a vaccine, or you have to take a drug, you have to go for a checkup. All of these things promote this gigantic hoax about what disease really is. And the fake epidemics are there as kind of, you might say, propaganda booster shots to the basic fallacy called the germ theory of disease.
That is another
topic. That's what I've discovered in the last 20, 25 years of reporting. And in my conversations with both mainstream reporters and even some doctors, they admit that they kind of grasp this, but they feel locked in. They can't escape. Their careers would be destroyed. Their bosses, supervisors, editors, if it's doctors, their hospitals, would blacklist them. They would no longer be able to work in their chosen profession.
John,
by
running,
pressure
John,
exerted
we're running
upon
out of time
them.
Here. Let me just mention this. You raise a very important issue. Is it the milieu, the Bichamp believed, or is it the microbe that Pasteur believed? Today, we don't look at the milieu of the body. We don't look at our capacity to develop natural immunity. We do not believe in natural healing as a society. And the medical industrial complex virtually controls the dialogue, they control the rules, they control the mandates, they control the funding. And they say that every single disease only should be combated with the militarization of medicine, the war on cancer, the war on heart disease, etc. So they've taken the same mindset they've used, and it has failed on the war on poverty and the war on drugs and the war on terror, the same mindset, and they put it here. Now, I'd like just to add this caveat. Ebola is real. It will kill people, and you can get massive hemorrhaging. The diseases you mentioned are real. The question that you're raising is, are these epidemics that justify the amount of attention? Their argument's going to be, well, thank God we didn't have an epidemic. That's simply because we were prepared and had the public educated and the vaccines or medication. And you'll be able to argue, yes, but it still wasn't reaching the proportion to justify all of the power that we gave you. And why didn't we have an alternative approach? Right now, we don't have democracy in medicine. I wish we did. John Rapoport, for all your good work over the last 30 years in investigative reporting, thank you. I want to thank all my panelists. We're out of time. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour.